Yesterday, Donald and I were both talking about the relationship between inner and outer. And this is something that we're going to be coming back to again and again, naturally, given our topic. And it occurs to me that the sort of thing I was talking about yesterday could be viewed as dealing with the relationship between outer freedom and inner freedom. That the main concern for Western social justice is freedom from oppression, freedom from institutions that try to control us, and that the main concern of the Buddhist tradition has been rather freedom, internal freedom, freedom for our own minds and from our own minds, because we can't really be free if we're still controlled by our greed, our aggression and ill will, and our delusion, especially our delusion of a separate self, our delusion that we can pursue our own benefit indifferent or at the cost of other people's benefit. So in a way, what I was trying to say yesterday was emphasizing the importance of bringing together both of those concerns for freedom, both of those projects or ideals, and how they not only supplement each other, but in a way they seem to need each other, to require each other. This morning I would like to focus on the inner, not only for its own sake, but what I would like to do is offer you a slightly different way of understanding traditional Buddhist teachings, a slightly different way of articulating that, a slightly different vocabulary, but one that I think is very valuable because it can help us see very directly and clearly the relationship between our own predicament, our own dukkha, and the larger social dukkha and the social predicament that we're a part of. So I want to start with ourselves, as Buddhism traditionally does, our own individual personal transformation, and how that then, how we can see an understanding of that then links so directly into the challenge and the necessity for social transformation. So what I'd like to start with doing is picking out what I think is the most essential teaching of the Buddha, the most distinctive teaching of the Buddha. And trying to show you how that connects with our social challenge today. And what is that essential teaching? Well, it obviously has to have something to do with dukkha, right? Because the Buddha said, as I mentioned yesterday, that all he had to teach was dukkha and how to end it. I think most of you are familiar with the term dukkha. Is there anyone here who's not so familiar with that? Well, we've been talking about it a little bit yesterday, so you're somewhat familiar, right? It's the word usually translated as suffering, but that only works if we understand it in the broadest possible sense, to include things like dissatisfaction, frustration, dis-ease. It really seems to refer to our pretty obvious inability to live very happily for very long, right? Dukkha means that even those of us who are relatively healthy and wealthy still experience a constant gnawing, something that keeps gnawing away at us. And the question is, why is that so? What is it that keeps gnawing? What's the source of that gnawing? It seems to be the nature of an unawakened mind to be bothered by something. And I think we know this. Even if we don't have a problem, we're very good at creating a problem or finding a very small problem and kind of blowing it up all out of proportion, right? And I think that's what dukkha is referring to, our inability to enjoy our lives. I'm reminded of Thich Nhat Hanh's definition, my favorite, of Buddhism. Buddhism is a simple way to enjoy your life. I think he said a clever way to enjoy your life. Yeah. So what's the source of that gnawing? And that's what I want to try to get at. The Pali Canon, the earliest texts that we have, they sometimes distinguish different types of dukkha. There's the dukkha that's obviously physical, mental, emotional pain. The Buddha said that this kind of dukkha includes being separated from the people that we want to be with and being stuck with somebody that we don't want to be with. And I expect he smiled when he said that. I think there's a lot of humor in the Pali Canon that we tend to miss. There's also the dukkha due to impermanence, the fact that the things that give us pleasure, like everything else, they're impermanent. They tend to pass away. And we know that even at the time that we have them. The worst example of this is our own mortality. Sometimes awareness of our own death sits like a kind of goblin on our shoulder, reminding us and keeping us from being fully able to enjoy our lives now, just because we know that they're going to pass away, that we won't always be here. But it's a third type of dukkha that I want to focus on, and it's the dukkha due to sense of self. This is that other if dukkha is the most important term in Buddhism, I think the second most important term is anatta, which is the term usually translated as no self, non-self, not self. And it's the connection between these two that I want to highlight. Because I think what the Buddha is really getting at is that our most fundamental, our most problematical dukkha suffering is connected with the sense of a separate self. In other words, the feeling that there's a me here and all of you and the rest of the world is outside, that I'm somehow inside and the world is outside. That somehow David Loy is where? Behind the eyes, inside the ears, but somewhere in here, and because I'm in here, all of you are out there, and it's the sense of separation. And what I think the Buddha is really emphasizing by talking about dukkha, or the dukkha of anatta, is the sense of separation, which is really weird because we all tend to take it for granted. That's just who we are, right? This is where I wonder if 20th century psychology can be very helpful, because it talks about it in a slightly different way. In those terms, we can say that the sense of self is a construct. It's a psychological, social, and even linguistic construct. Well, I mean, we know, like, babies aren't born with it, right? In order to gain a sense of self, certain things have to happen. We say psychological construct because it has to do with the way that mostly habitual ways of thinking, feeling, acting, remembering, planning, intending. It's the way that all of these habitual ways of thinking tend to work together to create a sort of self-image that then we think is us and we try to live up to, for example. And in order for this sense of self to develop, it's quite interesting what 20th century psychology discovered. Well, it's not really unique to them. But for example, you need to have other people who have a sense of self. That's how we get a sense of self. There's a kind of internalization. For most of us, that's our parents and maybe our mother. So, right? So your mother looks into your eyes and calls you by your name, the name that you've been given, and somehow we learn from these significant others that we're a self in the way that they're a self. In contrast to that, wolf children, like wolf boys, the wolf boy of Aveyron in France, stolen and suckled by wolves, maybe the parents die or something, if these children aren't recovered very quickly, they miss certain important developmental stages and they will never be fully human. Because to be fully human means to be socialized in this way as well. That we need this sense of self. And that I want to emphasize. It's not just that it's a problem. It's a necessary problem. Yeah. So, and also has to do, I mean, learning a sense of self is also very involved with learning language, learning how to use language in certain ways, especially pronouns. I, me, mine, you, yours, his, hers, and so forth. So it's the way that all of these things tend to work together. And I guess I want to emphasize that they're all processes. They're all, there's nothing substantial here. That everything that we can possibly identify as ourselves is a process. And it's the way these processes interact, work together, that creates this sense of separation. That's what the Buddha seems to be getting at. But we really haven't touched on the main point, which is, why is this necessarily dukkha? What's this? Why is this inherently something to do with suffering, so uncomfortable, so that there's a fundamental anxiety that's built into this sense of self? And here I think the talking about it in terms of a construction can help us. So the fact that my sense of self is a construct means that it doesn't have any reality. This me, this I, there's nothing substantial about it. It's not real. It's, as we said, it's the way that a bunch of processes work together. So the claim then is that below and behind these processes, there's no substantial thing here that they're covering up. One way to say it is that this constructed sense of separate self is therefore inherently insecure. It's not only insecure, in a way it has to be insecure because there's nothing there that could ever be secured. Another way to say it, it's not only feels ungrounded, but it's inherently ungroundable because there's no thing there that could ever be grounded, you see. And we can understand a lot of our problem as this feeling that we don't feel real enough. And we could understand the problem of our lives for most of us is we become preoccupied with doing things, projects that will make us feel more real, more secure, more grounded. The way that I usually like to talk about this is to say that therefore the sense of self, and again by self I mean separate self, this is the important point, that to have a sense of self is to have a sense of that which is not self, right? We're talking about the construction of a sense of separation, right? The way I like to talk about it is to say that the sense of a separate self is normally shadowed or haunted by a sense of lack, by the feeling that something is wrong with me, something isn't quite right, something is missing, something, there's something insufficient about me. And furthermore, I think this is one of the great secrets of life, that we all have this sense of lack, and we think that it's our own problem. We think other people are more or less okay, because we can look at other people and we see, you know, well, okay, you're there, but who's this me? That's, you know, I don't know what it is. I can't find it. And so I think it's something that we all have, but we all sort of tend to cover it up. I think it's especially strong for young people, adolescents, because they're at that stage of leaving the identity provided by the family and constructing their own, you know, independent identity and taking on certain roles in that. And so there's a lot of insecurity involved in that, of course. But I think we all have it. And I don't know that we normally ever resolve it. We just kind of cover it up. We cling to our certain social roles. We have a certain number of games we play, you know, roles that we play in relationship to other people, in relationship to our job and families and so forth. And we learn to identify with these roles and play them well to some extent. But nonetheless, this sense of lack, this sense of, it keeps gnawing away at us. It's still there in some sense. We haven't resolved the problem. Does this make any sense? And here's where the big delusion comes in, or the big ignorance. You know, Buddhism talks a lot about ignorance. And here's where the fundamental problem occurs, or the fundamental predicament, where things go wrong for most of us. Instead of understanding this sense of lack as sort of inherent to the sense of a separate self, instead of understanding what I would say is the real source of this problem, we turn it outward, and we understand our problem as something out here. We think, there's something I lack. What is I lack? Well, I don't have enough of this, or I have too much of that. But if only I had enough of this and got rid of that, then everything would be okay with me. So depending not only on the kind of personality we have, but also by the particular culture, society that we grow up in and are socialized in, we are socialized in different ways to understand what our sense of lack is. It's not just though we sort of decide, we tend to be conditioned by social forces, you see. Actually, I suspect that this sense of lack is inherent to self-consciousness. In other words, inherent to being a human being. And I would even sort of go back and look at the Garden of Eden story in this way, right? What does it mean to be expelled from the Garden of Eden? Well, a lot of people say it refers to self-consciousness. Huh? The Adam and Eve, they become aware that they're naked. They have to put on clothes, right? That's clearly referring to some sort of self-consciousness. More generally, I wonder if we could say this sense of lack is the origin of religion. As far as I know, human beings are the only species that have anything like religion, or need it. And I wonder if religion isn't our usual way, collectively, to address it, to sort of get right with the cosmos, with sacrifices, rituals, relating to the gods, keeping everything okay. That somehow it's when we collectively band together that there's a way of addressing this. For example, consider a French peasant 1,000 years ago. To grow up in his or her society, that French peasant would know the source of their sense of lack, because the society would give them an answer. Given the role of Christendom at that time, the problem would be sin. You've sinned. Not only have you sinned, but you inherit the original sin of Adam and Eve. And so you have an institution and a society structured around this institution where it not only tells you what your sense of lack is, but it gives you all kinds of ways to address it, right? Penances, receiving the Eucharist, going on pilgrimages, and the reassurance that if you live in the right way, perform the sacraments and so forth, after you die, you will go to heaven and everything will be okay. But in that kind of society, whether we approve of that understanding of lack or not, you see, to grow up, to be socialized in that society, is to have a way of dealing with this sense of lack. But here's where it gets interesting. The modern world. The modern world, our modern secular world, is largely a result of the Protestant Reformation and sort of what that sort of opened up. And so we live in a world where these kinds of religious explanations are no longer taken for granted, right? So, in fact, a lot of us don't believe in sin, and we're not sure what we think about karma. But what this means is we live in a world that doesn't acknowledge the need for religion and generally doesn't acknowledge that we have this sense of lack, which means not that the sense of lack isn't there, but we have to decide for ourselves. We have to decide for ourselves in the way that we don't have a collective way of dealing with it. So that we tend to understand the sense of lack in secular terms. And I think you can get a sense of what I'm driving at here. To grow up in 21st century America, we are conditioned pretty early to know one of the things that we lack, right? What is it?
Money.
Money. We don't have enough money. And it doesn't matter how much you have. You need more, because that's the idea. And so, and that's the way the system works, that here's the scary trap, that if you understand your sense of lack as you don't have enough money, it doesn't matter how much you get, because that understanding is a misunderstanding. It's a delusion, you see? So that it's a symptom of the more fundamental problem. So that you might think, oh, if I only had $1 million, then I'd be okay. You get your $1 million, but there's still the sense of lack, in which case many people say, oh, I was wrong. I don't need $1 million. I need $100 million, or I need $1 billion, right? That kind of game that's very easy to fall into there. One of the important things about money, let me just talk a little bit about money as an example of this, because there's a sense in which it is the most common way in which we tend to understand our sense of lack. And I think you can also see how this is going to help us, this is going to help us connect our individual predicament, our individual problem, with our social problem. Because money is not only a place where you and I are individually conditioned to understand our problem. We could say money is a place where our whole society is stuck, right? With offering us that understanding of what the problem of our lives is. We could say we have a society by emphasizing money that is deluded. Money is a great means, but a bad ends, right? We know it's necessary as a medium of exchange and so forth, but the problem is, because of the sense of lack, other things tend to get tangled up with it. It means that the most important thing about money is often its symbolic value. What do I mean by this? Well, there's different ways to say it. Money in our culture tends to symbolize for us the possibility of the satisfaction of all desires. And since we're also conditioned to think that the way to become happy is to satisfy desires, we're conditioned to think that money is the way to become happy. There's some wonderful stories that address this. I'm sure you're all familiar with the story of Midas and his golden touch. Very old Greek fable that we learned somewhere along the way. Actually, I think it's an extremely profound Greek myth, which in fact is probably more true today than it was back in the days of Greece. In the days of Greece, most households still produced most of what they needed. We live in a society that's so much more monetarized. Whatever wisdom there is in this fable is even more relevant to us. In fact, I would say I think there's a bit of Midas in each of us, right? You remember the story. Midas, he does a favor for the god Dionysus, who rewards him with a boon, and Midas says, although he's already extremely wealthy, one of the wealthiest people in the ancient world, he loves money, which for them is gold, right? Gold, give me gold. So he gets this golden touch. Everything he touches turns into gold. And he has so much fun touching things, turning them into gold, until it's time for dinner, right? Glass of wine, ching. Plate of food, Ching! His little daughter runs across the room. Ching! And he realizes that actually this isn't a boon, it's a curse. Fortunately, in the story, I think it's not only in the Walt Disney version, but in the original, that Dionysus takes away the curse. But what's going on here? Is this, in fact, a beautiful way of stating, of symbolizing the problem where we have this ends-means reversal between the means and the ends of money? But when I say, I think there's more than a bit of Midas in all of us, here's the question. Who of us, for example, today can drink a glass? What? Okay, a glass, maybe this isn't the best example in a Buddhist Vipassana retreat, I don't know. A glass of wine, okay? So you got a really expensive bottle. We're talking a couple $100 bottle of wine. And now, who of us can drink that wine without, you know, who of us can drink the wine fully enjoying the sensations, such as Donald was talking about, right? Fully enjoying the sensations, but how much of us is thinking, ah, what a clever wine connoisseur I am, and how cool that I can afford to buy this and enjoy this kind of wine. That's the edge that I'm talking about here, the way that the symbolism of money tends to pervade everything. Maybe a better example would be something like a really expensive car. I've kind of lost track what's the top dog car. I don't know, Mercedes, Jaguar, whatever. Anybody help me here?
Stretch Hummer.
Okay, Stretch. I don't know about that anymore with the price of oil. But if you can afford the Hummer, I guess you can afford the gas, right?
Yeah.
All right. But, well, let's say a Jaguar. Who of us could enjoy driving the Jaguar? I'm like, what's the enjoyment built into having the Jaguar? Is it that it's a really cool car that can go really fast, even if there's no roads that you can go really fast on? Or is it the sense it's a really neat car, and, you know, I'm the kind of guy that drives a Jaguar, you see? So it's interesting. It's like by becoming so wrapped up in the karma of money and the symbolism of money, we become ourselves caught up in the symbolism. It's not simply that we use money to evaluate everything, that it's not simply that we know the value, the price of everything and the value of nothing. It's not only that, but somehow we measure ourselves in terms of our wealth, in terms of the status that goes along with having a lot of money. And can we understand that as part of this way of trying to fill up our sense of lack? That this is the kind of response, this is the kind of response or solution to our sense of lack that our society encourages us to play. This is the game. If you want to fill up your sense of lack, if you want to feel more real, more grounded, more secure, you buy these kind of cars, you buy these sorts of things, and there's a certain cachet involved with them. Does this make any sense? Because I think this is really important, but as connecting, again, the fundamental predicament that Buddhism talks about, this delusive sense of self, with the kind of social forces, our economic system, such as we'll be talking more about tomorrow. But let me just point out a couple more quick examples, which I think is also pretty distinctive of our time. You know, the French peasant I referred to 1,000 years ago, he or she couldn't get caught up in this game because, number one, there wasn't much money around, really. And number two, if there was, they didn't have much chance of getting it. So they weren't going to, I mean, it's a good thing they had the church, in a way, because the financial option wasn't a way for them to fill up their sense of lack. But there's another one that I think is very distinctive about now, which we tend to take for granted, and yet I think it's also very much culturally conditioned. And this is the desire to be famous. Mm-hmm. The desire to... It's a very strange thing. Why would any of us want to be so famous that we couldn't walk down the sidewalk for fear of being mobbed? or in the case of John Lennon, shot, right? I mean, that kind of fame seems kind of weird, and why people would want it is in some ways hard to understand. Unless fame represents or symbolizes something for us, right? And it makes sense if you think about it. Today, we live in such a media-saturated world, it means that the kind of communication we're doing during this retreat is actually quite rare. We spend so much of our time in front of screens and relating to each other through screens, right? We're surrounded by screens, and in particular, thinking of television, cinema, but also newspapers, magazines, and so forth. And what are these screens showing us? In a way, the media is what is telling us what's real, right? More and more, we learn what's real. They determine what's reality for us, a kind of collective reality. And what's this collective reality? Well, maybe I watch one of these late night shows, and I see some guy, and number one, he's a lot better looking than I am. His jokes are a lot funnier. His stories are quite clever. If he plays a musical instrument, he plays it a lot better than I do. If he sings, he sings a lot better than I do. He's better dressed than I am. I'm sure his car is a lot better than mine, etc., 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 right? And so more and more we're surrounded by these people in the saturated media environment. No wonder so many of us have a problem with low self-esteem. There's a sense in which all of these people are presented to us. This is the real world. And in comparison to that, we are nobody. That there's a kind of anonymity in just being who we are. Does that make sense? I was struck a few months ago, I was reading an article about some FBI agents who did research into political assassins or would-be assassins, right? People who tried to kill some assassin. And they were looking into this. There was a big study and asking, you know, why did these people want to assassinate someone politically? And it was very interesting what they discovered. It didn't have anything really to do with politics. When they looked at the pattern of the lives of the people who tried this, they looked at the pattern of their lives the couple years before. They were failures. They were nobodies. They were really getting an incredible sense of frustration that their life hadn't worked. And they wanted to make a name for themselves because it was better to be famous or infamous for doing something terrible than not to be known at all. And that sounds really weird to us, but that's the pattern. There was a serial killer who was also quoted. He wrote to the newspaper of the local town. He said, "How many people do I have to kill to get a notice in the newspaper?" Or, you know, it's like, I don't know that he actually came out with his name, but the sense that somehow this will make you feel more, will give you some substantiality, some reality. Is this clicking? Does this make sense too? I think this says a lot about why we in particular are so fascinated by fame. As well as money. That these are maybe the two primary ways in which we are encouraged to understand and try to address our sense of lack in contemporary U.S. I mean, there's all kinds of other possibilities, of course, but I'm just saying that these are two of the primary ones which help us start to link between our own sense of lack and the kind of way that sense of lack tends to be institutionalized, structured within society. How am I doing on time? 10:40, okay. Let me just say one more thing briefly. Two things briefly. First of all, going back to the original point about sense of self as a construct, I think this can help us understand what Buddhism has to say about karma, which has become a real problem. in the modern world. Because in so many ways, karma, in so many ways, Buddhism seems a very modern, contemporary religion. What it says about the sense of self is a construct, that way of saying it. The way language deceives us, interdependence, insubstantiality. In a lot of ways, it seems very modern. But what do you do about karma, and what do you do about rebirth? Because there's nothing in the scientific worldview that, or even the real cultural one, that seems to sort of help to explain what's going on there. What I just want to suggest very briefly is that what I've said about the constructed sense of self can help us understand how karma works. Karma was already a common belief at the time of the Buddha, but it was traditionally within Brahminical society, it was understood in a kind of mechanical way. It was just how you, if you hired a Brahmin to do a ritual and he did it in exactly the right way, then you would get the reason. Maybe you wanted a son. They often wanted a son. So if you did it in exactly the right way, you would get what you were sacrificing for. The Buddha's really revolutionary take on this was to emphasize that what creates karma is motivation, your intentions. Really profound, a kind of ethicization of karma. What he seems to be saying is that if what you do is motivated by greed, aggression, and delusion of self, you're going to create problems for yourself, as well as other people. But if what you do is motivated by the opposites, instead of greed, generosity, instead of ill will, loving kindness, instead of delusion, the wisdom of our interdependence, a life motivated by that will mean that you experience the world and the world will respond to you in very different ways. And this makes sense in terms of what I was saying earlier. If we say, okay, this sense of self is composed of all these habitual ways of thinking, feeling, acting, and so forth, what are the aspects, what are the components of the sense of self that relate most directly to other people, to how we experience, how we relate to other people? Well, it obviously has to do with our motivations. Right? So, and we don't even have to understand this working in a kind of magical way, although I don't deny that there's a lot of mysteries here. But fundamentally, okay, if I'm motivated by greed, ill will, delusion, I'm going to be manipulating you to get what I want from you. And that's going to cause problems sooner or later, right? But if I'm motivated by generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom, then I can open up. I can be some kind of person. I can be transparent. I don't have to play those manipulative games, the games that would reinforce the sense of separation. And the basic point there, of course, is simply that people are going to feel that. It's like, if I'm relating to you in a selfish way, self-centered way, sooner or later, you know, you feel that and you're going to defend yourself. But if I'm relating to you in a more open, transparent way, there's something attractive about that. And the tendency will be to respond in the same way. I'm not saying that that's always the case, but to a large extent, that seems to be what goes on there. We're all old enough and experienced enough to know that the vast majority of the time, people respond to us in the way that we speak to them. It's just sort of built into our human nature, for the most part. Obviously, there are very important exceptions to that. All of this was framed in a very beautiful way in an anonymous little poem, which maybe you've heard before. It goes something like this. Sow or a plant, in the sense of planting something, sow a thought and reap an action. Sow an action and reap a habit. Sow a habit and reap a character. Sow a character and reap a destiny. Thought, intention, leads to action. Action, again and again, becomes habit. The habits form our character. And our character, not always, but often involves a certain way that we're going to be experienced and experience the world. I think it's very, very profound. What I've just been talking about is what you might call the reconstruction of the sense of self, right? Transforming our motivations. It's as if the Buddha is giving us this very simple but golden key. He's saying, if you want to transform the way you experience the world, the way that people respond to you, it's very easy, it's very simple to do. Sorry, not easy. It's simple, it may be very tough, but it's the principle is quite simple. Instead of being motivated, instead of what you do being motivated by greed, ill will, delusion, transform your motivations and the way that you experience the world and the way the world responds to you will change. I think that's really, really profound. That's what the Buddha is getting at by emphasizing the motivation, the cause side of karma. But let me just finish by saying just a couple words, because that's, of course, not the only Buddhist response. Buddhism not only talks about reconstructing the sense of self, but also deconstructing it, to realize the emptiness of the self in order to wake up and realize our true nature. And again, this helps us understand what's going on when we're meditating, for example. If you're meditating, a lot of the same ways of thinking and feeling and so forth that come up in your daily life, they still come into our mind, but we respond to them in different ways, okay? Say, maybe normally I'd be sitting in front of a TV, maybe watching a football game or something, and there's the thought, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have a beer? And you go to the fridge. Again, I know these are good Buddhist examples. Actually, I don't do this very much. This isn't beer, this is chocolate and sweets, by the way. But just as an example, okay? So, okay, watching the football game, oh, wouldn't it be a commercial? Time for a beer, right? You get the beer, and of course, we all know what happens. The beer's gone, you didn't even know you drank it, right? Right? But when we're meditating, if you're meditating well anyway, you don't get up and get that beer, right? Sort of, you might have that thought, you might have all kinds of similar thoughts, all the normal thoughts, or many of the normal thoughts that normally, you know, fit together, compose in part our sense of self, all of those thoughts would come to mind, but we don't respond to them in the same way. We let them go. Whatever our meditation theme is, the thought comes, we don't identify with it, we let it go. But remember, if the sense of self is composed of all these habitual ways of thinking, feeling, and so forth, what are we doing by letting them go? We are letting go of the sense of self, right? The sense of self is sort of decomposing, deconstructing. And this is how, at least in the Zen tradition, we talk about the process of realizing our true nature. It was well summarized by the great Japanese Zen master Dogen, who said, to study Buddhism is to study yourself. To study yourself is to forget yourself. In a way, that's what you're doing. If you're letting these things peel away, you're not identifying with them in the same way. You are kind of forgetting yourself. You're making friends with this emptiness at the core, this lack, this groundlessness that we're normally so uncomfortable with and running away. We're making friends with that. And although meditation in itself doesn't lead to awakening, as Trungpa said, awakening is always an accident, but meditation makes you accident prone. Again, because you're not identifying with those things, right? Letting them peel away, getting a sense of the emptiness, right? So the awakening, well, here's the way we talk about it in the Zen tradition anyway. So awakening is a kind of letting go. This fundamental sense of separation, this fundamental sense of duality, I'm here, you're out there, is a kind of a letting go of that sense of self. One way to say it, it's the realization that David Loy isn't this guy somewhere in here, even though I can't find what this thing is I'm supposed to be. David Loy isn't in here. David Loy is one of the innumerable ways in which all the causes and conditions and of the cosmos, of the whole universe, come together right here and right now. And not only me, of course, but each and every one of us. The only difference between us and a Buddha is that a Buddha realizes this fully and lives according to it. In other words, my mind isn't in here. As Dogen said, I came to realize clearly, he said after his own awakening, I came to realize clearly mind is nothing other than rivers and mountains and the great wide earth, the sun and the moon and the stars. My mind, I'm not in here. I'm one of the many, many ways, each of us is one of the one of many, in which all this comes together. Can you see the social implications of this? Can we see the implications for the Bodhisattva path? Let me stop by offering you a wonderful summary. I have to end with this summary because if I start with it, it's so perfect, I have nothing to say. It's not even by a Buddhist. It's by Vedantin, Nisargadatta. And he said it so beautifully. Nisargadatta, an Advaitin, died about 1980, 81. He said, when I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. Between these two, my life turns. Say it again? Yeah. When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. Between these two, my life turns. Mm-hmm. Wisdom, love, wisdom, compassion, the two wings of the Dharma. So obviously there's a lot of things that can and will be built upon that, but we'll stop there for the moment. Thank you. I think it would be good, we want to have an opportunity to break up into small groups and talk a bit about this, but I think it would be good to start with a few minutes of meditation. So this is a guided meditation. Please reflect. What was said about the sense of lack that is the other side of the sense of self. Do you feel that? And how do you tend to understand and experience your sense of lack as you live in the world? What are your own lack projects, the ways in which you try to fill up your sense of lack? So like yesterday, we would like people to form into groups of four or five, and I think best with different people than you were in last time, maybe so we get around and get to know other people. And the topic would be, as I tried to say during the meditation, number one, does this sense of lack, this claim about the sense of lack being inherent to the sense of self, does that really resonate with your own sense of your life? And number two, what are the particular lack projects, that's as I like to call them, the things that we get involved in ways that we hope will sort of, our projects to feel more real, our projects to ground ourselves. But again, projects that don't usually work very well because they can't. Yeah. Does that make sense? Okay. So we'll be in groups for a while, and then we'll come back together again at the end. Okay. So if you'd form those groups of four and five. Any questions?
Maybe give them a sense of how long.
Yeah, what do you recommend, Donna?
About 25 minutes.
We can say 20 and then it's good. Okay. So it'll be for about 20 minutes. The sessions will be about 20 minutes. Then we'll all come back together again.